My name is Marcus Casey. I'm a volunteer meditation instructor here at Columbus KTC. And although we are blessed with two resident lamas, Lama Kathy and Lama Tom, when they are away, Lama Kathy has asked a few of us to fill in and give talks for her. Lama Kathy is up at our home monastery this week in outside of Woodstock, New York, and is at a retreat there. And Lama Tom is usually here on the fourth Sunday of the month, and I know he's been traveling. He just attended the Kagyu Munlam, the prayer festival in India that our lineage has every year. So he has been in India. When the lamas are away, we are going through we always go through a book study of one of the books by our lineage masters. And the book we've been going through for a while now is called Meditation, Advice to Beginners by Bokar Rinpoche. And it's out of print. That's why we have copies like this. It is currently out of print, but it is so helpful and so clear that we wanted to teach from it anyway. Now, one generous donor has done the printing of the whole book. So if someone wants to come up afterwards, I have one copy. It's first come, first serve. If someone wants a copy of the whole book, if these talks have been very meaningful, I am happy to give that away to someone. So this week, the chapter that we're going to be studying is called Further Information on Mental Calming, or Shine. And further information is a really good title for this chapter because he's been talking about Shine, calm abiding meditation, for many chapters. And in this one, he goes over a whole bunch of things that apply but may have not fit somewhere else. So it's kind of a whole collection of topics and some very valuable information. There are practical topics like posture, which I know has been covered a little bit before. What to do when we're sleepy or agitated. I really like that section. As well as inspirational topics where he talks about the blessing of a teacher and reminds us how fortunate we are to be receiving these teachings. We traditionally say the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning of our talks. The prayer is in Tibetan, so some of you may know it, but for those who don't, feel free to just listen and make the aspiration that you will awaken and then help others to awaken. When we are chanting this, we're repeating the commitment, our commitment to taking refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, or the goal, what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, our guides and companions on the path. We chant the refuge prayer three times. Om Sangje Chudang Sogi Chog Nam La Jang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin Sogi Pe Su Nam Yi Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Du Par Shu Sangje Chu Dang So Gi Cho Nam La Jang Chu Bar Du Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Da Gi Jin So Gi Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Du Par Shu Sangje Chidang Sogi Chog Nam La Jiang Chu Par Yu Dang Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin Sogi Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pin Chir Sangje Du Par Shu. Okay, the one thing that has always been existent and present with us for as long as we have existed is our mind. It doesn't really matter for this consideration whether we're talking about just this lifetime or going back many lifetimes. The fact is we've never been separated from our minds. But what do we really know about our minds? Bokar Rinpoche says we only have a superficial idea of what our minds are. We think of it as the part of us that experiences happiness and suffering and is conscious of our field of experience. He says that it is because of our lack of knowledge of the truth of what our mind is that we endure suffering, difficulties, and everything that makes up samsara. Meditation, on the other hand, leads us to the discovery of our mind. This is not something where I'm going to stand up here and tell you what your mind is. You have to discover your mind through meditation. And it is a lack of understanding of our minds that is what has us caught in perpetual suffering. So the discovery of our minds that we can do through meditation is the way we can become liberated from suffering. Seeing how important knowledge and the discovery of the mind is, it can end our suffering after all, we have to figure out how to find the way. We need a path. And Bokar Rinpoche tells us that there are no worldly means that will give us what we need. What we need is a spiritual path or dharma to help us discover what we truly are. My middle daughter, right there, likes to try to stump people with hard questions. And her go-to question here, and I've heard her ask it from the question microphone, and she's asked me at home, is this. If Shakyamuni Buddha didn't have Buddhist teachings, didn't have a dharma to guide him, didn't have teachers who knew the way, how did he become enlightened? And there's a big explanation to that question, and I won't answer it all right now. But one of my first reactions when she asks that is, well, it was a lot harder than it had to be. Shakyamuni Buddha nearly meditated himself to death. He went the path of asceticism for many years and almost died from it. Now, he later found a middle path between the extreme of indulgence and the extreme of asceticism. But fortunately, because he did accomplish what he did and then taught his disciples, who taught their disciples, and on, all the way down to 2018, we have an unbroken lineage of the instructions that we need. By the way, they call this unbroken lineage the Golden Mala, or Golden Rosary, and it's referring to the fact that the teachings have been passed down from teacher to teacher to teacher to teacher, all the way, and just like the beads follow on a mala. And this is how we have a living lineage and an alive dharma. Particularly in the Vajrayana, like we are, the relationship to a teacher is very, very important. The recognition of the ultimate nature of the mind is made possible by the grace of a teacher who is endowed with deep realization. Now, I know that word grace might trip some people up. So, Bokar Rinpoche says, non-material and indivisible, it is like a force or an extremely strong current under the influence of which we place ourselves through our trust and devotion. And the common meaning of grace that we might think of if we have been taught the concept of grace, especially in previous religious traditions here in the West, with a Christian upbringing, for example, you might think of it as receiving something you did not deserve. And the concept here can be kind of similar. The blessings or grace from the guru gives us a boost. It makes things a little clearer. It makes the mind a little less obstructed because of our connection with an accomplished teacher. So the teacher's great karma and great aspirations for beings become a benefit to us. If that word trips you up, we often use the word blessings in place of the word grace in Buddhism. And one way to approach it, if it is difficult for you, is to consider whether or not you believe that when a person becomes enlightened, it changes the person. So if you believe that enlightenment changes a person, it's not much of a step further to say that it also would change the way they interact with and connect to others. And what we're saying when we talk about grace or blessings is the idea that an enlightened teacher can impact another person from within on a level that maybe you or I don't have the ability to impact someone through. So when we're in the presence of an enlightened teacher, we are often very inspired or uplifted. And actually, it's really common to see someone be uplifted when they're in the presence of an enlightened teacher, even if they're not a Buddhist, have no connection to the Dharma or to Buddhism. I think of the effect that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has on many, many people throughout the world, most of whom are not Buddhist. But on meeting him, he's just a lovely person and connects with them very strongly. In some ways, when we meet an enlightened teacher like this, it's as though there's some kind of outside agency, something outside ourselves, that activates our Buddha nature. Lama Kathy gives the example of two tuning forks. So if you strike a tuning fork and then hold it up next to the other tuning fork, the other tuning fork begins sympathetic vibration with that first tuning fork. And that's sort of the way an enlightened teacher can activate our Buddha nature within. And this is especially true if we approach that teacher with devotion. Now, there's another word that trips people up a lot of times for Westerners, and is a little bit difficult. So the Tibetan word for devotion is mugu, and that's basically two words, mu and gu, and one of them means enthusiasm, and the other one means respect. So what we're talking about in our teachings when we talk about devotion is enthusiastic respect for a teacher. So the question then is, does this response come from outside ourselves or from within? And I don't know. The answer is probably both. But the last Kali Rinpoche described it as this way. He said, the compassion of a teacher is like a hook, and our respect and devotion is like a ring. And when our respect and devotion for a teacher meets that teacher's compassion, it hooks in. And he said, the teacher can then lead us from happiness to happiness and then to awakening, was his quote. When we turn to them, what they are is reflected in what we are. So Boka Rinpoche offers a simple guru yoga practice that is often taught as a beginning practice before a session of meditation. You start by visualizing an enlightened being, the Karmapa, or any other teacher, with a deep realization. You imagine them sitting on a lotus seat above your head. You don't see them as being flesh and blood, but rather as being made of light. And then you repeat the following prayer and supplicate the teacher as many times as you wish. I pray for your blessing, my guru, great and completely worthy spiritual friend. I pray that you will cause love, compassion, and bodhicitta to arise in my mind. And we usually say that in English, and we repeat it 3 times, 7 times, or as many times as we like. Often we'll use a mala to count how many times we want to repeat it. And then at the end, after you've repeated it as many times as you wish, you visualize the teacher melting into light and merging and being absorbed into you. As Bokar Rinpoche says in his book, in this way, we receive the grace fully, our body, speech, and mind of the teacher. So that's a, you know, when I think about teachers and the way to approach, the availability of teachers in the West, I meet so many people that, you know, they say, well, Pema Chodron's my teacher, for example. Pema Chodron is a wonderful teacher. She's an excellent teacher. She's one human being who is known by thousands and thousands, if not millions, of people. So she's not necessarily accessible on a one-on-one basis to most people. And if you have the good fortune of having access to a well-known teacher, that's fantastic. But most people do not, and they connect with these teachers through reading their books and through videos and things like that, or maybe in an audience of thousands. And that's all great. But I only say that in contrast to the fact that here in Columbus, Ohio, of all places, we have access, one-on-one access to teachers and to our teacher's teacher in New York and things like that. It's a very fortunate position to be in. So as a little aside, if you are starting a practice and you've never scheduled a one-on-one interview with Lama Kathy, I encourage you to do so. That can be a great help to guide your practice in a way that works for you and that makes sense for you. So Bokar Rinpoche wants us to stop and reflect on the good fortune we have received. And this is just one way we've received good fortune, is the fact that we have access to such great teachers and such a living lineage of teachers. Bokar Rinpoche says, in considering our good fortune, consider animals. Now, if your mind immediately went to your pet, that's all well and good. But understand that the life of a pet is not very representative of the life of most animals. Tibetans actually say that a dog is in their last lifetime before becoming a human. So that's kind of the top, right? But truly, in the animal world, most animals live lives of extreme difficulty. It's a constant struggle for survival while under the threat of being eaten. And if we could understand how much suffering they endure, we would realize how fortunate we are to have a human existence. Then Bokar Rinpoche says, consider other humans. Have you ever noticed how we walk around most days not even giving a thought to how great it is that we're in good health? We don't really think about that until we're sick. And then when we're sick, all we can think about is what we're going to do when we get well, right? But when we're well, it just kind of passes us by to be grateful for our health. And Bokar Rinpoche says, often it is only when we are touched by unhappiness that we are conscious of the value of our previous happiness. So when we're not contemplating our good fortune, we tend to take it for granted and squander our present good health or favorable situation. So what Bokar Rinpoche is saying is, consider others, consider animals, consider where we are and the good fortune we have, and the fortune that we have to be receiving these teachings, to understand that negative actions accumulate the causes of future suffering, and that we have the possibility of learning and practicing a spiritual path. That is very rare, and we are very, very fortunate to have found this. So the idea when we consider our good fortune is to use that as motivation to practice, to use that as motivation that what we have found is so rare and precious that we don't want to let this precious situation pass us by. We want to use it wisely. Now, the next thing Bokar Rinpoche talks about are different stages of meditation. So far in this book and in the previous chapters, we've been talking about the first stage of meditation, which is calm abiding meditation. Shine is the Tibetan word. The Sanskrit word is shamatha. We often call it mental calming. We have a lot of words we refer to it as. But that's only the first stage. And there is a second stage. Now, I won't go into great detail about that second stage today because it's the subject of the next couple of chapters. So you'll want to be sure to come to those teachings to learn more about the second stage of meditation. But that second stage in Tibetan is called latong. In Sanskrit, it's called vipassana. And we refer to it often as insight meditation or emptiness meditation. Now, these stages don't exist from the point of view of the ultimate nature of the mind itself, but it is a good description of the path. And so students are usually directed to practice the first stage before moving on. I've read an analogy that helps me to kind of understand how these two stages fit into the path. So consider our ego fixation as a big tree. And you've got an axe, and that's your mind. But right now you've got a very dull axe. The kind of meditation we've been talking about, mental calming meditation or shine, sharpens that axe. But if all you ever do is sharpen your axe, you're not going to get very far cutting down the tree. Likewise, if you try to jump straight into the second stage of meditation and start cutting down the tree, if you haven't first sharpened your axe, you're not going to get very far. So this is the way shine and la tong work together. You work on sharpening your mind, on letting your distractions calm down, and increasing your abilities to focus and concentrate. And then you use that to develop insight. So that's my little teaser for what's coming up next. But again, that'll be in future talks. The next thing he talks about, and I know this has been talked about in previous chapters, is posture. And we talk about it every week in our intro class for those who have attended the intro to meditation class. But posture is very important, and I think that's why he includes it multiple times. Posture allows our bodies, when we get in a good posture, our bodies are stable so that then our minds can develop stability as well. And so that is what we're going to dive into in detail. Bokar Rinpoche also talks about the subtle winds in our bodies, or the way energy moves through our bodies. And he says when you don't sit in a very stable way, your subtle winds are very disrupted, and that also causes distraction. So we teach posture in 7 steps, starting from the ground up. And many of you have heard this. So the first is how you arrange your legs. The most stable way, if you can do it, and some people can and many people cannot, is in yoga we call it the lotus position, and here we call it the vajra posture. But it's basically right ankle or right foot on top of your left thigh, left foot on your right thigh. And I want to give a caveat here that you can injure yourself if you try to do this when you're not actually ready or when it's not right for you. What I have found is that, I mean, in the 60 seconds of sheer pain and zero meditation that I've done when I've done this posture, right? The nice thing about the posture is you don't necessarily have to have a cushion. You don't have to necessarily elevate when you're in that posture. You're just kind of very self-contained little package of stability when you're in that posture. If you can't do that or can't do it well or still meditate like me, another posture is basically to the sattva position where one leg is in front of the other and both knees rest on the mat. Now, when you do that without a cushion, you kind of end up having to engage muscles to try to stay upright, and you're just not quite so stable. So that's why we often use cushions when we do that. And that way you kind of end up with a tripod with your rear end on the cushion and both knees on the lower cushion or on the floor, and that kind of, it gives you a very stable base. So, of course, if you have any physical limitations that mean that you can't sit this way at all, and many people do, there are other ways you can do it. There are little meditation benches that people use, and then they kneel, but they're actually sitting on the bench. The bench goes over your legs, over your ankles, basically, while you kneel, but then you're not putting your body weight on your ankles. That helps some people. Other people, you just use a chair, feet flat on the floor, and sitting forward, usually not sitting back against the chair, but sitting forward a little bit so that the spine can be straight and your body can be very, very stable as well. Now, the second step is an internal step that we call drawing up. We kind of tuck the buttocks under us, close and tighten the internal sphincter muscles of elimination, pull our abdomen in and up, and then relax. So it's kind of a drawing up, but you kind of, when you draw up, you kind of stretch a little further than you normally would, and then let it relax back into a relaxed position. So again, we're looking for a balance here. The middle way. I talked earlier about how the Buddha found the middle way between the extreme of indulgence and the extreme of asceticism. This is the extreme of being this is the middle way where you are both stable but not rigid. You're stable but you are relaxed. So the third is how to place your hands. Now, there are many ways that we place our hands. Kimpo Karcha Rinpoche teaches a way in which we place our thumbs under our ring finger, under our fourth finger there, and just gently close into a very gentle fist, and then place them on our thighs. And that's the common one that we teach around here. The fourth step is to straighten the lower part of your back. And again, the way I like to do it is to go too far and then relax. So it's really to give a good stretch of that curve and then relax it back to what's natural. So you're not slouching, you've done that big stretch, but then you relax back to what's actually going to be comfortable. The next step is to pull your chin in slightly so that you feel the neck align with the spine, so that you're kind of not sitting like this, not down here, but you just kind of just slightly tuck that chin in. Very slightly, and it just kind of opens up some of the neck. The sixth step is to place your tongue against your upper palate, and that's a good way to avoid having problems with saliva or whatever during the meditation. It's a very natural position once you get used to it. I recognize it feels a little awkward if you're not used to putting your tongue on the roof of your mouth. And the seventh step is to place the gaze of your eyes. Now, this one can be a little bit hard to figure out, I think, for a lot of people. What's the angle? Where do I place my eyes? How do I keep from getting distracted on things? So the idea is that you want to have a very soft focus. You're not staring at something. You really just want to have a very soft focus. and I'll try to do this without hitting my microphone. The best way I've seen it taught for the angle is to touch your nose with your elbow kind of tucked right in right here, and then just straighten that out in front of you. So think of that fingertip as kind of the angle that you just let your eyes rest on. So it's not extreme. You don't have your eyes pointed way down and you're not looking straight ahead. It's right down at a soft angle just a few feet in front of you is a very nice way to relax your eyes. Now, we usually do keep them open. There are exceptions to that, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes when we get to the discussion of sleepiness and agitation. But those are the seven little checks that we do when we start a meditation. Legs, draw up, then place our hands, then straighten the lower part of the back, pull your chin in slightly, put your tongue on the roof of your mouth, and then rest your gaze downward. Then after we get in this posture, we can take one deep breath that fills the abdomen, exhale, and then mentally follow the breath as you breathe naturally in and out. And natural is an important point. You don't want to sit down to a session of meditation and start controlling your breath, start thinking you need to breathe slowly because you're meditating. No, let your breath go naturally and you just watch what it does. Now, if you've been very active and then you sit down and meditate, your breath might be running quite fast at the beginning and might slow down during the meditation session, but you want to let that happen naturally and happen on its own. Now, I'll make a quick admission at this point. When I do Shine meditation, I go into exactly the posture I just described. I follow the steps and I do exactly what I have described. However, a lot of times when I do other practices where there's chanting involved or mantras involved or something like that, I tend to slouch. I tend to rock back and forth gently a little bit as I'm doing it. And I'm realizing, no, this is a good posture regardless of the practice you're doing. I only mention that in case someone else has slipped into that habit as well. That's something I'm working on, is making sure I get this posture regardless of the practice I'm doing. So once you've got your body stabilized, then you want to stabilize your mind. Bokar Rinpoche uses the analogy that our thoughts are like an elephant. And our mind, you know, tramples all around, wild elephant. And we use a support for our mind, and that's like a rope. Sorry, our attention is the rope. What we tie that attention to is the support that we use in meditation. So often the support we use is our breath, and that's the one we most commonly teach. So by taking that wild mind and using attention to place our mind on the breath, it kind of anchors the mind. Just watch the breath going in and out. And when we direct our attention to the natural movement of our breathing, we consider that our breathing and our minds are one. We follow the inhaling and exhaling with the mind relaxed and without distraction. So there are other anchors or objects of meditation, we call them, that we can use when we do this type of meditation. In addition to the breath, another one that you may try, I don't know, this one's a little bit adventurous because it's not something in our normal sphere of reality, is a white tigle, or a little white sphere of light that we imagine at the base of our foreheads. And again, we consider our minds and the tigle to be one. And we just kind of concentrate on that visualization of that little white sphere of light. Another one we can use is the Buddha Shakyamuni in our hearts, the size of our thumbs, clear and brilliant. Again, we focus our attention on this visualization, And again, the Buddha is undifferentiated from our minds. Now, we talked, Lama Kathy talked last week about several other things that you can use. So really, we're not very limited. The nice thing about the breath is we always have it. It's always available. And that's great. Lama Kathy also mentioned that if you have done a lot of meditation and you've done a lot of meditation with a single support and you're used to that support, there's not necessarily any reason to change which support you use, which object of meditation you use. You might want to experiment a little bit, but if something works for you, it's not about the object you're using. It's about anchoring that mind that's easily distracted. Now, there's also a type of meditation that is meditation without support. And in this meditation, the mind remains concentrated on itself, on the letting go, and on the not acting. And Bokar Rinpoche uses the example of a flag on a flagpole. When the wind isn't blowing, neither the flag or the flagpole move. When the wind is blowing, the flag moves, but the pole doesn't. And in this metaphor, our thoughts are like the flag. Thoughts can be moving, or they might be settled down. But regardless, the mind in Shine without a support is like the flag pole. It is conscious and vigilant and not moved by the thoughts. Without following nor attempting to stop the thoughts, one keeps the mind both relaxed and non-distracted. A little thing I would say here is that if you are starting out, and many of us are, and compared to many of our teachers, no matter how many years we've been doing it, we are still starting out. The having an object of our meditation is very helpful. And so I would only try to move on to Shine without a support at the direction of a teacher. Now, the next section, Bokar Rinpoche talks about the two enemies of Shine, which are sleepiness and agitation. And the measure to which we face each of them really depends on our nature. Most people will notice that one dominates. It's important to analyze and understand which one dominates so we can apply the appropriate remedy. If we're not conscious of which one dominates in us, we can risk increasing them, because if we don't analyze our tendencies, we might approach meditation with what comes naturally, which might just kind of double down on the problem we're having. And what I mean is this. So the remedy for sleepiness is to tense our mind a little bit, open our eyes. Remember, I talked about how we vary a little bit the way we do our eyes. If you're struggling with sleepiness, you will want to open your eyes wider. Open our eyes widely and think that we are looking at the sky. So the what you need to be careful of, though, is if you are someone who tends towards sleepiness when you meditate, you might tend to approach meditation as something, as a relaxing thing. And then because relaxation comes naturally to you, so you might be looking for an excessive state of relaxation, and what you end up with is mental dullness. So if you have the tendency toward sleepiness, instead you open your eyes brighter, you tense your mind more, and you imagine that you're looking at the sky. On the other hand, the remedy for agitation, if we have a tendency to get carried away by our thoughts, we should relax, close our eyes, and imagine that we are looking at the ground. So we're relaxing our mind. If you follow your tendency and you're someone who's really a type A type person, you might tense your mind and say, okay, I'm going to meditate no matter what, and you're actually tensing more when really you need to be relaxing. So that will really only increase your thoughts and you won't feel at ease, and meditation will be very difficult. As an aside, Bokar Rinpoche says that mental agitation is more common with his students in the West. So the other thing I think is to approach these very skillfully. Sometimes when you sit down to meditate, your tendency may be agitation, but you might be very sleepy in this particular session. So apply the appropriate remedy. For me, I noticed that meditation in the morning, my mind is already trying to start the day. It's trying to be agitated. Meditation at night, my body's trying to calm down and relax, and sleepiness is the enemy. So again, know yourself, learn yourself, and apply these skillfully. Now, Bokar Rinpoche says, whether or not our tendency is towards sleepiness or agitation, when one practices shine, it is important to place one's body, speech, and mind in a state of ease and openness. The mind should feel happy without fidgeting. One should not feel a sensation of being in a narrow, closed room, but rather have the feeling of being outdoors in a pleasant place. It is indispensable to be at ease, relaxed, and open. These are the cornerstones of meditation. Now, Rinpoche goes on to say that when you reach a point where the mind naturally calms down and becomes thought-free, this is true shine. But there are two types, a correct way and an incorrect way, of having thought-free meditation. The first is like your thoughts settle down because your mind has become dull or obscured. And he says this is incorrect. Real shine is characterized by clarity rather than obscurity. So the absence of thought with clarity is true shine. But he says that can only come about naturally and progressively. This kind of clarity cannot be obtained through willpower or using the mental faculties. It is a component of the nature of the mind itself and will show up as our obscurations clear. So it's important to understand the difference between a dull mind without thoughts and a clear mind without thoughts so that we'll be able to recognize if we're on the right road or not. Most of us will not be able to establish ourselves in a perfect shine right now, and you shouldn't set that expectation because you will be disappointed. What you should do is to accept meditation as it is presently, with or without clarity, with or without thoughts. What matters is to meditate and persevere. So we shouldn't try to force our meditation to be something. Practice according to the instructions you've been given, and then let it be what it is. I hope these sections from Bokar Rinpoche have been helpful. I personally really love how he approaches the problems of fatigue and agitation in meditation, and I'm trying to start making it part of my practice when I sit down to kind of take a quick inventory of the state of my mind before I start, and then just tweak accordingly my posture and my mental attitude accordingly to try to offset the tendency I have at that particular meditation session. So we have 15 minutes or so for questions, and we have a question microphone up here. Questions or comments, anyone who wants to can come up and ask questions. Yes, Jeremy.
Yeah, I got a question. Yeah, I think it's on.
It's on now.
I don't know if it's if I'm too far into the book because I couldn't put it down. I just, you know, I was obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. But so I don't know if I'm too far ahead or. But my question is, Bokar, he explains meditation and during meditation to that we can't find the mind. He goes on to explain the mind is not outside of ourselves and we mm-hmm. can't find it in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this part confused me because in science, you know, you learn that mm-hmm. they can hook up these things, and then they can tell what areas of the brain we're using during certain, you know, things or whatnot. So can you expand on what is he explaining? Like, what's sure. the Buddhist philosophy on that, or mm-hmm. what is he trying to get at, that there's no mind or?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So this is you're right. This is coming up later, but in the book.
Oh, sorry.
But that's fine. That's fine. So this is from a series of contemplations where we are really trying to get at what the nature of our minds is. And what this does, we in the West tend to conflate or equate our minds and our brains. And actually what's funny is in some cultures, especially in Asia, it's the they consider their mind to be in their heart area,
yeah, that's
rather
what I heard
than
too,
in their head.
And it confuses me.
Right. When you contemplate, you can actually put your attention in your foot. Try it sometime. Make your attention go down to a specific area or a specific pain or a specific something like that. Mm-hmm. And what it's trying to make you understand as you do that contemplation, our brains, science has told us that our brains are a support for our minds. But our teachers tell us that the two are not the same thing. It does not necessarily exist just in our brains. And the point of what this whole teaching is getting at is discovering that our minds are not a thing. It's not that they're nothing. It's not that there is no mind,
mm-hmm.
but that it's not a thing. And to try to break us out of that by looking for it. Try to look for where your mind is and figure out what shape it is, what color it is. All these things are some of the further contemplations that we do. Okay. And the idea is to really come to a realization that although our minds are not nothing, they're not a thing. They're not a thing. And that's a difficult thing that takes some practice. But,
yeah.
But that's
so
what
is
you're
he trying
doing.
To break you out of grasping or like attachment?
Right. Ultimately, yeah. You're trying to recognize the true nature of your mind. And that mind is pure awareness. And yeah, it does help with breaking you out of attaching to your current situation, your physical surroundings, your body, and things like that.
All right. Thanks. All right.
Thank you. Hey, honey.
If you're trying to think about nothing, I can't do that. So mm-hmm. am I practicing wrong?
Good question. So you're not necessarily trying to think about nothing. What you're trying not to do is to follow those thoughts when they do come up. So thoughts will come up, and you want to look at them. It's called touch and go. Lama Kathy calls it touch and go. You want to kind of touch that thought and say, oh, I'm thinking, or oh, I'm worrying, or oh, I'm daydreaming. Whatever label you want to give it, just touch it and then let that thought go so that you're not giving it mental energy, so that you're not trying to direct that thought. Bokar Rinpoche in a previous chapter gave the example of waves in the ocean. So your mind is like the ocean and your thoughts are like the waves. The waves in the ocean are of the same stuff. They are the same thing. They're both water. But what we have a tendency to do is think that as those waves arise, we have to do something with them. We have to direct them. And what he says is, we just need to sit on the beach and watch. The waves will come and they will go. Thoughts will arise. And then if we don't give them mental energy, they will just settle back in. So you don't have to do any trying to let go of your thoughts. you just put your mind on the support, which is your breath, and then touch and your thoughts as they come up and let them settle. And they'll go away of their own over a long, long period of time. Your mind will settle more and more. It will become less like a waterfall of thoughts and later more like a still lake or pond. Okay?
Another question, what is the appropriate thing to think of?
The appropriate thing to think of? So what you want to do is not to follow thoughts, but instead of thoughts, you want to pay attention to what your attention is on. Is your attention following those thoughts? Or is your attention anchored in the object of your meditation, your breath? So you want to take that attention and just let that attention rest gently on the inhaling and exhaling. But that's not really the same thing as thoughts that come and go. It's a little different function. Your attention is a little different function of your mind. Does that help?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a, just wondering if you could elaborate perhaps on more tips on when your mind's agitated. I've noticed in the last week when I attempted a daily practice, sometimes when I approach meditation, kind of so anxious, not necessarily about meditating, but just about the Rolodex of to-do things in my brain, that it gets to the point where it's very difficult to sit, let alone kind of meditate. So I was wondering if you can maybe speak to either conditions or what one could do to kind of move past that.
Sure. So several things. Number one, when someone starts a practice, they often will get discouraged because they sit down to meditate and their thoughts are just all over the place. And a lot of what's happening there is your thoughts were always all over the place. You're just sitting down and noticing them right now. And so I don't want you to get discouraged by the fact that you're sitting down and what's coming up are your anxieties, your to-do list, your stress, things like that. It was always there. You're now slowing down and letting your attention be on the workings of your mind, and you're noticing it. I just used the metaphor of a waterfall. Over time, and this doesn't happen immediately, over time, meditation helps us to slow that waterfall down until it is a still ocean. But it doesn't happen all at once. So when you sit down and you're very agitated, one thing Bokar Rinpoche said was it might help to close your eyes instead of keeping your eyes open. And he says visualize the ground. Visualize that you're looking at the ground. Kind of try to ground those thoughts. And then realize that this is a practice. It's not a performance. So we say around here the only bad meditation is the one you didn't do. You are not gauging the success of your meditation by the state of your mind. That's not what that's not really the right gauge of a successful meditation session. The true practice in meditation is how many times is the dropping of that agitation and that story and those thoughts. It's not in how many thoughts are there or how many thoughts come up. It's that touch and go. It's those times that we drop. That's exercise, and you're exercising a muscle in your mind. You're exercising the muscle of being able to let go. So A lot of times I like to think of it this way. The more agitated your mind is, the more opportunities you have for doing that touch and settle. And even if that settling only lasts a couple seconds and boom, your mind's right back into it. Once you catch yourself, once your attention gets on it, you touch it and settle. And over time, you just get better at that. And over a long time, then what happens is you learn to create a little bit of separation. I talked earlier about how our attention and our thoughts are not necessarily the same thing. You get a little bit of separation from your thoughts, and then off the cushion, when you notice your thoughts going round and round too, you've got that little bit of mindfulness outside of that, that notices that, that touches it, and lets it go. So what you're doing when you sit down and you have a very agitated mind is exactly the exercise you're supposed to be going through when you start a practice. And so it's not at all unusual, and that is what you'll notice. I would say starting out, it's very helpful to meditate for shorter periods of time, but regularly, maybe more often. 5 minutes every day is going to be better for you than half an hour once a week, that type thing. So stay within your means, within where you are right now with your mind, but just keep practicing that touching and letting it settle. I'll also say that our circumstances and our minds go through changes and ups and downs, and sometimes we have more trouble with things like that than others. So, does that help?
Yes.
Okay. I think this will be the last one. Thank you.
When I was listening, every time you like have a class, I kind of have like an experience. I correlate with it the week before.
Okay. You know? All right, give it to me.
So you were saying like the state between like in the morning, it may be a little bit rougher because the mind is looking for stuff to gather, and then at night, it may be harder because the mind is looking for stuff to drop away. So I kind of figured that the easiest for me, taking a philosophy of the middle path, was taking a path between waking and sleeping in my meditation. Mm-hmm. So getting to a point where I wasn't necessarily awoke, but I wasn't necessarily asleep, so I could actually see the components not only in my conscious mind, but the things that were hitting from me or controlling me. So I figured out the ability to think is like a mirror, or like you said, a river. If you can still it can reflect back to you perfectly. So what I realized taking the middle path, or is just a suggestion talk meditation, is going between the state of conscious and sleep and being able to still that river, or the river of mind. So you therefore, the whole point of meditation is to basically accept your whole self, know thyself, essentially. So what that does is, if you can still that pool and be in that space between asleep and the awake, you can integrate the components of yourself that you thought you knew, your conscious self, and then the components of yourself that you didn't necessarily know or hid away. And you can reflect them perfectly in the pool and bring them together and become enlightened. Or holy, which is the whole point of the word holy, is to integrate every aspect of it. So that's just some insight.
No, that's very interesting. I don't have any experience with trying to do that, so I can't talk to it directly. I will say that Tibetans talk about many bardos. When we think of the bardo, or when we hear the word bardo, and you're hearing from a Tibetan standpoint, you're mostly thinking about that state between being alive and being reborn. So you think of that state after you die. And bardo, really, it's a border, and they talk about multiple bardos. And one of the bardos they talk about is that between waking and sleeping. They talk about that bardo. So again, I have no experience with meditating in that state. I think you know, I would advise that you make sure you have a teacher directing you, and you, I would advise you to take some of these experiences to a qualified teacher, to Lama Kathy or something. But excellent. Thank you for sharing that. All right. So let us dedicate the merit of bringing ourselves on this time change weekend and listening to Boko Rinpoche's teaching. So mentally dedicate the merit to all beings. By this virtue, may our meditation progress, that we may remove the obscurations to our true nature, and then lead every being without exception to that state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.